So I'm not a huge college basketball guy, but I watched a lot of Princeton this past weekend as they shocked everyone by reaching the Sweet 16. And on more than one occasion, I thought of Grant Wall, my former Sports Illustrated colleague who, as you surely know, died last December while covering the World Cup. Grant was not only a Princeton grad, but a person who wore his love of the university on his sleeve and his hat and his scarf. And while I dig seeing the Tigers storm through the tournament, I really wish that my old colleague and friend were here to experience it. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, the podcast where one writer, me, talks writing with another writer every single week. And today's guest is Darren Urban, the azcardinals.com Arizona Cardinals beat writer who's covered the team for 24 years. That is a lot of John Skelton and Rex Hadnott. This is episode number 303. Let's sing some Yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks.
And nobody cares about your stupid TV show.
All right, Darren. So you are the director of editorial content and senior writer for azcardinals.com. You first covered the Cardinals for the East Valley Tribune, and you've been with the team's website since 2007. We are coming off a year that I think most people would agree, not the best for the Arizona Cardinals. Usually, if your coach gets fired and your GM leaves, it's not the best year. As a guy from a newspaper background, and now you write for the team's website, do you still have at all impulses of like, I'm just going to write about the shit show and blah, 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 that you have to, do you know what I mean? That now that you work for the team, you have to kind of restrain to a certain degree.
I would say yes, to a certain extent. I mean, obviously, as you mentioned, I've been doing this for 15 years. So, you know, you kind of understand where the line is. And the line is different with every team with somebody like me. I am super fortunate that I'm in a place that when they hired me, I remember giving them a line like, if you just want me to write PR stuff, you could hire two people right out of college to write PR stuff for the same amount of money it would take to get me. So what would be the point of that? And they made it clear that they didn't, that's not what they wanted. Are there lines? Of course there are lines. But yes, ultimately, there are times when I'm like, you know, where you might know a little something or you might want to go in a certain direction. But again, like anything else, Jeff, you kind of learn over time how to do what you need to do. I mean, one of the things I'm fortunate about is with my background, you know, I can ask guys questions and believe it or not, more often than not, a player and or a coach, most of the time a player will get you a quote that is in the direction that you need to go, where you don't have to necessarily say what you want to say, but the player will say it and you're able to give that message. And again, I'm lucky enough. It's not like I have somebody over my shoulder saying, if it's bad, you can't ever write about it. I'm very fortunate. There are not a ton of teams in the NFL or period that allow that to happen, but I feel like for the most part, I can say most of what I need to say. I mean, I'm never going to completely lay the hammer, but I can say some things.
I know what it's like to cover a very bad team from a newspaper standpoint, right? And in a way, there's some fun to it. Like I've covered bad baseball where it's kind of fun to slam on a team. What is it like to cover a bad team when you are also an employee of the team? Yeah. Like, what does that feel like? Game 15 of a crap season.
I covered this team for 7 years with a newspaper and then came aboard here. So definitely was like full bore into like how I would cover the team as a newspaper guy. And when I first started, it was 07. It was Ken Wisenhunt's first year. They actually went 500, which for this franchise was a big deal and much better than any team that I'd covered when I was a beat writer. And then the next year they went to the Super Bowl. So it took me a couple of years to have to deal with that, but it's not easy because there are certain stories that you would write as a beat writer and or a columnist that you're just not going to go after when it's a really bad season and things are kind of just in that realm. But there are still stories you can write. You're talking about, you look to the future a lot more, which as a beat writer, you're going to tend to do sometimes too. I think ultimately it's finding people to give you the quotes to say the things that you want to say. I mean, I remember last year when the Cardinals were awful in the wild card playoff game against the Rams. And I'm like, okay, we all know this was completely terrible. How am I going to do this? And then JJ Watt came in the room and he just, we were crap, we were this. And so you just, my whole story was based on JJ Watt and what he said, because he said everything that anybody else would want to say anyways, except to have it on the record. And you're kind of lucky in that regard.
Wait, I like getting nerdy. So I'm going to get nerdy here. Team loses a game. It sucks. It's miserable. You need to get quotes from players who are miserable. It is post an embarrassing loss. Something. What are the ways to talk to players after a shitty loss?
That's a great question. I think I find myself, and you've been in these locker rooms too. First of all, a lot of the players have a good idea who I am. Now, COVID really jacked around with a lot of that stuff, because there's a lot of players on this team the last couple of years that didn't get to know me as well as they would have normally, because I wasn't allowed to go in the locker room and I wasn't allowed to be around them. So it was a lot more like I was a quote unquote regular media person. But when I know these guys, it's a little easier for me to kind of sidle up to them, which I think has gotten more and more difficult if I was on a regular newspaper beat. I feel like it's not quite the same as it was when I was covering the team 20 years ago. But, you know, you sidle up to them. There's definitely, if it's not a group thing, there's definitely that funeral-esque whisper that you're kind of like, hey, you know, this is, you try and get into it, not with the hardest question. And again, you know who you're asking. If you're going to a veteran who understands that it was crap and you know how they kind of handle things, it's, you can kind of come right out and say it. I'm like, you know, what's the deal? What's the problem? And you kind of just let them go. If it's a younger player and they're still a little bit guarded on how they might want to talk about it, you kind of approach it at a different angle. And I do feel like, and now I'm sounding like get off my lawn guy, but I feel like players were a little bit more open a little bit and more willing to say stuff 15 years ago. It's gotten harder and harder to not get guys to be cliche ridden. And that doesn't change for me or any other media member. And I don't know how much of that is where the college game is gone, where like these college coaches, I mean, the number of players that were stunned when NFL locker rooms were open again this year and didn't realize media got to come in locker rooms because they were in college where it never happened. And then they came into the NFL where COVID said you couldn't. They're like, wait, media gets to come in the locker rooms?
Like you had guys literally say, what are you doing here? I mean, that kind of genre.
Fortunately, it never quite leaked out that way. The stories I heard from the PR staff when they're like, okay, guys, like we're going to have media in here. Wait, what do you mean we're going to have media in here? Like, what is that? You know, because again, they're just not used to it. And it impacts obviously how it goes. Now, every guy is different. And you know that too. Like in a football locker room, there's lots of guys who are a little bit more personable, a little bit more willing to talk, and other guys that aren't comfortable with it. And that kind of thing. Or maybe they came from, you know, a program, one of the really big programs where it's all so super guarded and everybody controls everything. It's definitely been kind of eye-opening for me too. And I hope as we get further away from the COVID stuff that we get a little bit back, more back to normal. So, you know, and I keep my fingers crossed on that, but we'll see.
You're a 92 college graduate. So we're about the same age. I'm 94. Yeah. So we've both been doing this a long time. I have never enjoyed going into a locker room or clubhouse ever, 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 ever. I just find it super awkward. And people talk about women going in, and I'm sure it's a million times more awkward for women, but I find it awkward too. I do not enjoy it. Do you feel like now at this point in your career, you're super uber comfortable walking around a locker room?
So the deal on that is yes. Now, would I still feel comfortable if I was still essentially external media? I don't know. I mean, the benefit of my job is when I get to work every day, the way our facility is set up is it's kind of like a long hallway thing. And there's like three levels, and I park not near the front entrance. I park in the back, and then I walk in the back because I want to walk through the players area. Now, once upon a time, the locker room was open in the back. They did some renovations a few years ago. So now the locker room, you have to go in a door and everything, but I still walk through where the cafeteria is and the weight room. And part of the reason I do that is so that these guys see my face. Some of them might not know me right away, some of them, but everybody has an idea when I'm walking through there every day that, okay, this is somebody. And so that makes it a little bit easier. It makes it easier when I can walk into the locker room in non-media times, which I can do. I don't do it a ton. I'm not going to, you know, overstep my bounds, but like a couple of the equipment guys are friends of mine, go down there, chat with them. If I want to work ahead and on a story, it makes it a lot easier for me. Hey, I want to definitely get this guy one-on-one. And it's a lot harder when you're in the locker room and, but frankly, so many media members are just waiting for the scrum anymore. And I don't want my going up to a guy and trying to get him one-on-one turning into a scrum. So I try and go in there on a Monday or Tuesday when there's no regular locker room access and say, hey, can I get you for 5 minutes right now or whatever, so I can kind of get what I need to get. So for me, it's a little bit different of a situation. So yeah, I think there's a comfortability. Although I will say, once COVID ended, the first few times, the very first time we went in the locker room this year, because the Cardinals didn't have open locker room in training camp. They didn't have to do it until the regular season or games. So they held off. So the first time we were able to go back in the locker room after 2 years was their first preseason game, which was on the road. And I went in there and it felt weird. And we definitely got looks from players like, wait, what are you guys doing in here?
All right. So I recently took my nephews to Six Flags. And if you go to Six Flags and you pay extra money, you get the fast pass where you can cut the line. Right. And everyone stares at those guys like they're the biggest assholes in the world. Cause I've been waiting an hour and a half to get on this coaster and they're just Do you have the fast pass and do you ever get looks from the other media members?
I think once upon a, it's funny when I first made the transition back in 2007, the landscape was a lot different. There was a couple of guys like me. I talked to Jeff Hobson, who is a former newspaper beat guy who took the job with Bengals.com back in 2000. And I remember thinking to myself at the time, wow, he gets to write some stuff on that website that I'm surprised because that's newspaper stuff. And I talked to him. And when I went over, I'll be honest, I wasn't sure I wanted to jump the fence because we all know how, especially back then, what newspaper guys and quote unquote journalists, big J journalists thought of team writers. And I almost didn't, despite getting the offer of a fairly decent raise, but I chose to. And I definitely got some side eyes from, you know, people in the Pro Football Writers of America, not all of them, but they, you know, you kind of get those glances. And I think when I first started on the beat, I was fortunate that my main competition, the Arizona Republic beat writer at the time, was Kent Summers. And he's one of my best friends. And he was somebody I leaned on in terms of talking about whether I should do this. So he knew what the deal was. I think he understood that could change some things in terms of the access. And then as we've gone, unfortunately, the way the media has gone, I don't think any of these guys care as much anymore. But every once in a while, there's that side. But I've been around this long enough. I mean, I've been covering this team since 2000. There's nobody covering this team that has been around as long as me. And almost all of them know me as the AZCardinals.com guy. Most of them don't know me in my past life as newspaper. So I'm the guy who usually opens the press conferences with a question. Because you're the old guy, you're the dude who's been around the longest. I'm comfortable doing it, and everybody just kind of knows who I am. And I don't think at this point there's really any jealousy because everybody's just trying to get along at this point, unfortunately.
Right. When you first started covering the Cardinals, 2000, they were 3-13. The coaches were Vince Tobin and Dave McGinnis.
Yes.
And the quarterback was Dave Brown out of Duke. And if Dave Brown walked down a street in Phoenix right now, I'm guessing 0 of 100 people would recognize him, maybe 1 out of 100 if there's some closeted Dave Brown fan. In 2023, a quarterback is Kyler Murray, who would be recognized in any city in America. He makes an ungodly amount of money. It strikes me, and this is not just about Kyler Murray, that covering quarterbacks sucks, that you don't get much access, that they're treated as divas and rock stars and blah, 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 blah. What is it like? But maybe I'm putting words in your mouth. I don't mean to do that. In fact, I hate what I just did. What is it like to cover Kyler Murray?
It's been interesting. You're not wrong. You know, when I first got in here, it was Dave Brown took, I think, the most snaps that year because Jake Plummer was hurt. But Jake Plummer was here. And Jake Plummer was a rock star kind of for the Cardinals. But again, they were a bad team. They had made the playoffs 2 years before, and then it just all fell apart. And it was pretty crappy the entire time I covered them. For a newspaper. And we had Kurt Warner here. Kurt's a great guy. He was always approachable. Carson Palmer was always approachable, especially for me, but he knew what we were looking for. Kurt kind of knew what we were looking for.
Is that good or bad?
I think it's usually good because, like, Carson was a guy who I don't think he was, like, the number of times my department, whether it was me trying to do a story or our video side, wanted to, like, we asked Carson, hey, is there any way we can come visit you in the off season and see what your house is like? He was nice about it, but he had no interest in doing that. Mm-hmm. But if you asked him a question in a press conference, he knew where you were going. Like, he would give you an anecdote. You're like, oh, that's gold. That's exactly what I'm like. Now, is he giving you state secrets? No, but he knew how to give you stuff that was interesting, and he knew it would be interesting for our readers without giving up the farm. I don't know if guys these days know that as much. Kyler has gotten better. I like Kyler. He seems to like me. I have a decent relationship with him. I do not get the sense media is his favorite thing. That is something he's had to warm up to. Usually with most quarterbacks in the past, because of my spot, I can usually go up to a guy and say, hey, can I grab you for two quick questions? Okay. Kyler would prefer that I go through PR to set something up. I wish it didn't have to be that way, but I'm not going to lie. There's a couple other guys in the locker room who are kind of that way too. And I think that's just where we are now, where I used to be able to go up to anybody. And now it's kind of hit and miss. But with Kyler, again, you're talking about a kid who has always been successful. For the most part, I know he had the little blip in college where it didn't work out at Texas A&M, but then he ends up going to Oklahoma and it works out just fine. And he's been doing this since he was 10 years old, and you're going to think a certain way. And I'm fascinated to see, I have not had a chance to talk to him since he blew out his knee. I'm fascinated to know what this does to him, having this kind of adversity, because he really hasn't had this kind of adversity. Obviously, they weren't winning as many games here all the time, but he hasn't had this kind of personal adversity before. So I'm curious to see where that goes, but I think he's gotten better. But I look back, I see Kyler Murray at 25 and some of the things he's done, and I think of Larry Fitzgerald. I covered Larry Fitzgerald's entire career. When he walked in the door, when he was at his first training camp, he wasn't even legal to drink. And let me tell you something, the Larry Fitzgerald that I knew at 30 and 35 and these days, he is a different man than he was when he showed up at 20 and 21 and 22, when he would try and blow off the media and when he would run out of the locker room after games before the media even got in there so he wouldn't have to talk, and was always super guarded. And he grew up over the years. And I would sense that the same thing would probably happen with Kyler Murray. And it goes back to that other thing too, Jeff, where we expect some of these guys when they're 24 and 25 to act like they're 40, and they're 24 and 25. And it doesn't make it okay all the time if you're rude or whatever it is. But at the same time, there's got to be some kind of leeway. I've got a 23-year-old son and one that's about to turn 21. And God, I shudder sometimes to think of what would happen if somebody put him in a press conference all of a sudden.
Wait, that is such a fascinating point, because I want to say, first of all, when I started my career at the Tennessean, I spent 2.5 years in Nashville. I was such an immature asshole. I didn't want to listen to anyone. I thought I knew the answers to everything. You know, it was age appropriate. That's what I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think too often we forget that these guys, not only are they young, but they grew up in bubbles, like sports bubbles. Like Kyler Murray grew up in a bubble.
Yes.
So like to expect him to just be like this man of the people and mature and like it's insane, right?
It's nature versus nurture. And all these guys, like we were just talking about the quarterbacks, like Kurt Warner is going to interact with people as a quarterback way differently as a guy who, I remember when I covered the Arizona Rattlers and I covered an Arena Bowl and they beat the Iowa Barnstormers, and I went in the locker room to talk to Iowa quarterback Kurt Warner well before I ever covered him with the Cardinals. And it's like he had a different way of coming up through it, and he wasn't in that bubble. And it's just going to change things dramatically. And yeah, a lot of these guys come up through bubbles. You know, my kids both played basketball. They weren't very good at it, but they played. Props to them. So I did a little bit of the AAU thing, not super high level by any stretch, but I was around it. And at the high school they played at, my older son especially, they went through a run. I mean, when my son was a sophomore and on the JV team, the varsity team won state, and three other guys on their team were Saban Lee, who's in the NFL and NBA. He plays for the Suns right now. Alex Barcelo, who was just one of the best college guards in the with BYU last year, and he's playing overseas. And Marvin Bagley, who was the number two overall pick in the draft. So there's this team, and I'm watching these guys, and you know, my son went to middle school with Saban, knew him well. Alex was a little bit more of a bubble guy in a bubble because he was kind of more of a prodigy. And then there was Marvin, who showed up at Corona as a freshman, and his dad's taking video every step of the way for a future documentary and is treated in such a way. And then after his freshman year, got whisked away to a prep school because dad wanted him in a different place. Right. And Marvin cried the day he left Corona, the high school, because he wanted to just be around these guys. And instead, he's being shuffled into this different thing. And it worked out fine for Marvin, but it's like, these guys do grow up in a different thing. And I can't imagine what it was like for Kyler knowing, especially once he got here and he'd been a top 10 baseball pick and people were giving him money hand over fist. And I mean, you are going to be a certain way. And then that doesn't even include the type of personality you are, which with Kyler, he's an introvert. He likes playing video games and everybody wants to make that a punchline of everything. But one of my kids is the same way. He likes kind of holding up in the room and not being around a lot of people and kind of being on his own. Nobody looks at athletes that way. We all say, well, you're an athlete. That's what you are. And there's no room for what kind of person you might be when it comes to some of this stuff.
You know, when I was at SI, you'd profile some guy in college and he'd be like, you know, before he was doing so-and-so, he would be out with his friends, or he'd be on the rodeo circuit, or he'd be collecting tin cans, or he'd be, you know, all these things. That was all a thing, all these background interests. And I feel like nowadays, if you read through a media guide, it's like in his spare time, enjoys Xbox, in his spare time, enjoys Switch. And does that take away from our ability to profile these guys in interesting ways, that their backgrounds are in front of a screen?
I don't think there's any question about it, because it's just, there's only so much you can say about that.
Love is Call of Duty.
Well, and that's the other thing too, is like, even if somebody was really good at it, even if that gave you an avenue to profile him, is that person going to want to be profiled in such a way when we see, for instance, the Kyler Murray backlash when people talk about him playing video games? I mean, it's difficult. It's a bigger thing. I got worried about my kids growing up for a while there because I didn't feel like they had a lot of close friends, because that's not what they did. And that's not across the board. Other kids, some kids are different like that, but like it absolutely wasn't like, now I'm definitely get off my lawn guy. It absolutely wasn't like what we were like growing up when I would, you know, for the longest time, I didn't have a big group of friends growing up, but there would be a handful of us. And we'd play a essentially 2-on-2 baseball with a tennis ball. And we'd find like tennis courts where we could kind of like have ghost runners and all that. Kids didn't do that very much because you did have video games and you did have these screens. And it's a different world we live in. And yeah, the athletes that we're breeding right now, that sounds terrible, but the ones that we're bringing up now, what are they doing? A lot of them are playing video games at home. When they're on teams, there's a lot of club stuff and there's jumping all over around, and you don't get taught a lot of fundamentals at a lot of these places, whatever sport it is, because if the coach gets too hard on them, we're going to pick up and move to another team.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden you don't have a club anymore. And it's the transfer stuff in college. It's free agency. It's all that stuff. And I'm not saying if that's good or bad, but it is what it is. And it is impacting absolutely the professional athletes that I see, because this is how they're coming up.
There's something to be said for failing your driver's test. There's something to be said for having a crush on some girl at school and she has nothing to do with you, and you ask her to the prom and she says no. There's something to be said for failing a test. There's something to be said for having a shitty season in basketball. And I feel like we are skipping a lot of those developmental, we're just going to move you to a different school, we're just going to take care of this, we're going to take care of that. Yeah, just it's crazy. It's crazy.
And then, and that's, and again, that's why I wish I would never wish this injury on Kyler Murray.
Right.
But is this kind of adversity, does this impact him? We'll see what happens. Again, I wish he would have stayed healthy for a lot of reasons, but you're right. My son at one point, and he'll kill me for bringing this up, but
he's not listening to this podcast.
Probably not. He broke up with a girlfriend, a longtime girlfriend from, he's in college now, but they were in high school together. And it was really, quite frankly, like I said, he wasn't a great basketball player, but he always managed to make the team because he was a good team guy. He was willing to sit on the end of the bench and not play and work hard and practice, all those things.
Sports writers.
Yeah, exactly. So he never really had any adversity. He never got cut from a team. He didn't have to work very hard in school to get good grades. So he had this, he broke up with his girlfriend and it was hard for him.
Right.
And I told him later, much later when the timing was right. And I said, I think it was good for you because it's really your first major setback.
Yeah.
And you needed a setback, dude.
Yep. I feel you.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. And I'm here with my son, Emmett. And we just saw Creed 3.
You can't do this ad for RoyalRetros.com.
What do you mean?
I mean, no one believes in you. You're over the hill. You haven't done an original advertisement in years. It's over.
But I want it. Bad.
So what are you gonna do about it, kid?
Royal Retros is the king of sports merchandise. Its throwback gear is sizzlingly dope-alicious. And if you go to RoyalRetros.com right now, you can order anything from a Selwyn Dree and Arizona Wranglers jersey to a Hartford Whaler snapback hat. It's the king, I say, of old school retro sports merch, motherfuckers.
You're like Rocky V, where old brain dead Rocky gets his ass kicked by Don King and Tommy Morrison. You should hang it up.
You're Adrian giving me a pep talk?
No, Dad, really. Royal Retros is great, but you suck.
I have a nerdy question for you.
Yes.
You wrote on March 2nd, 2022, under the headline, Andy Isabella gets permission to seek trade. Your lead was, after 3 years and little use on offense, it's safe to say the path of second-round wide receiver Andy Isabella hasn't gone the way he or the Cardinals thought it would. So it wasn't a shock when it came out at the scouting combine that despite the Cardinals having questions about the return of free agent wide receivers Christian Kirk and A.J. Green, the multiple reports revealed the team had given permission for Isabella to seek a trade. Andy Isabella, famously, 2019 draft, he's picked number 62. Two slots later, DJ Metcalf goes to the Seattle Seahawks. How quickly did you realize this was a mistake?
The thing about the Isabella part was, again, there is some context. There's a reason DK Metcalf was on the board in the second round when a lot of teams took receivers in the first round. Some of them were good. Some of them were not. There were questions about DK Metcalf and what he was going to be able to accomplish on this level in terms of some of the wide receiver things you need to do. It was Cliff Kingsbury's first season. They were trying to get in at that point. He was absolutely going to try some kind of air raid type look. He wanted small, quick receivers. And the thought process was after what Andy Isabella did in the Senior Bowl and some of the things he did against better competition as a senior year, hey, we might get another Wes Welker, who Cliff had known at Texas Tech. So I think that was some of the thought process. Now, Andy never clicked. He's not a natural catcher of the ball.
Might be a problem
for a wide receiver. And he was quick, but his best attributes were probably on the outside. And at 5'9" or whatever he was, that probably wasn't going to work. He didn't work as well on the inside. And it just, every time they might have given him a shot, it just didn't work. So that first training camp with Cliff was very interesting because everybody was looking at Kyler because it was his rookie year. They drafted three wide receivers and none of them panned out. Now, none of them were in the first round, but you get Andy Isabella, you get Keyshawn Johnson, not that Keyshawn Johnson,
yeah,
and Akeem Butler, who never worked out. And they all basically flamed out. And you needed receivers. I mean, another problem Andy Isabella had here was you already had Christian Kirk, who basically was best in the slot. And at that point in his career, Larry Fitzgerald was best in the slot. He wasn't an outside guy anymore. And all of a sudden you're drafting a guy and you're putting him behind these guys. So there was a lot there, but I would probably say you started getting a little nervous that first season, few games in, and then that second training camp, you're like, especially after what DK Metcalf did, because let me tell you something, There were plenty of fans who were ticked off the very moment they took Andy Isabella over DK Metcalf. And I have heard nothing but that since then. And it still gets brought up. And I understand completely why it has. I mean, in fact, when Steve Keim officially left the organization recently, that's like the first thing that got brought up. Good, we got rid of the guy who drafted Andy Isabella over DK Metcalf.
Does any of this make you feel bad for Andy Isabella, or is it just business and like whatever?
I would say, being in my position, and you've always got to be really careful about this, Jeff, and this is the thing, but I do get to know some of these players better than most. And I do get to know some of these coaches better than most. And when Cliff Kingsbury gets fired, do I think they needed to make a change? Yes. Do I feel bad for the person that I got to know a little bit? And I didn't even get to know Cliff that well. Yeah, I feel bad for him. I think he's a good man. I think he worked his ass off. It just didn't work here, but it wasn't for lack of effort. So yeah, I did feel bad for Andy Isabella. But once you cover pro sports, you hear the cliche over and over from players, especially, I know it's a business, or I just learned it's a business, or now I know it's a business. Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Right.
You know, I've been around it for way too long. I've seen too many guys that had to learn that the hard way. I've seen too many guys that had to go through it. The best story I have of that is Adrian Wilson, who works in the front office here, was close with Steve Keim, and Steve Keim became general manager. And one of the first things Steve Keim did was cut Adrian Wilson, and they were tight. I mean, that went back to NC State. There's nothing harder than that. And he did it. And Adrian took it like a man, and because he understood that his career was winding down. And you see that up close and personal all the time. Not all fans really get that. There are people involved here, and I see that up close.
There was an age when beat writers and head coaches had a real sort of interesting relationship. In fact, back in the day, you would go out for beers with the head coach. And he would say, meet me down at the hotel bar. We'll talk. We'll have a couple of beers. This is all off the record, but blah, blah, blah. And he would give you background. I mean, very Billy Martin-ish, very Davey Johnson-ish, very yeah. New York, but also a thing for a long time, wherever you went. And again, you covered Cliff Kingsbury. He was there for 4 years as a head coach of the Cardinals. And you just said you didn't really get to know him that well. Is the relationship of writer and coach just what that is, or was he a specific type?
I think, again, it depends. Cliff is very much of a, I think he is another guy, which is funny for a position he's in. I think he's introverted in a lot of ways. I think a perfect day for Cliff Kingsbury is sitting in a room and looking at tape and drawing up plays. And if there are people there, okay, but it's not the best. When I sat down with him, I got like a half hour to do a one-on-one interview, because I did the whole, when he first got hired, the big, oh, who is Cliff Kingsbury story.
Yeah.
And he was fine, but he wasn't sitting there giving me anecdote after anecdote. And in fact, I called a ton of people, and I was able to get a ton of people who told me some really good anecdotes. And I went back to him at one point. I said, hey, I heard that the year you were hurt with the Patriots, you essentially became like a de facto quality control coach, because like Charlie Weiss kind of put you to work. And he looked at me and he goes, who told you that? I'm like, I don't even remember off the top of my head, because I was telling him in passing. And he wasn't mad, but I think if it had been his choice, I wouldn't have known about it.
Right.
And it was just, he's just not comfortable. And it's weird over time. You know, when I work backwards, I got along fine with Steve Wilkes. He was only here the 1 year. Didn't get to know him super well because he wasn't here so long. Bruce Arians, I knew while Bruce Arians was here, I told everybody that would listen, and I told everybody in our department, understand right now, it will never get any better for us than this. This dude says what's on his mind. He doesn't care what we do, as long as we don't like show some onside kick being practiced at practice. Do whatever the hell you want. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get to know him super well. Bruce wasn't a big small talker guy. You know, he was nice, but I tried to small talk him a couple times. It just didn't work. Ken Wisenhunt was smart, but he was a guy that by the time the end was here, and we're on good terms now, but by the time the end was here, he didn't have much use for an in-house reporter that was writing about a bad team. That was one where it butted up against it. We never had words per se, but I do remember one time right at the end of his tenure, and I had written something that was done in a group setting. He's like, you need to understand, Darren, you are not a journalist. You are not a journalist. I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, I don't, I understand that I'm maybe not a newspaper writer, but I'm like, you know, I struggle with that. That if you want to talk about one thing I do struggle with, Jeff, is the no, and it doesn't seem like it happens as much now. It happened for a while there. If a player, a coach comes up to me and says, why would you write that? You work for the team. Like I really get my hackles up and I understand what they're saying, but like, I feel like saying, don't play poorly then. I'm not hammering you by any stretch of the imagination, but I'm not going to sit here and write that it's rainbow and unicorns. I want people to come to our site and read it. We're not Patriots.com. We're not Steelers.com where you could put a picture of paint drying in Steelers colors and people are going to click on it because there's 8 million zillion Steelers fans. I want people to have a reason to come to our website. And to me, that's covering the team as best I can and keep my credibility.
Do you ever get tired of the machismo bullshit of football? Like I just saw a video of Colorado, some assistant coach at the University of Colorado speaking to the players. And he's like barking at these guys. And he's like, we here. And when I come in here, you stand up. Everyone stand up. And he has them stand up. Now sit down. And he said, and I'm like, what is this nonsense? Like what? You're not in the military. It's a fucking football team. Like does machismo, does that stuff ever bug you or no? Is this a part of it?
You don't see it nearly as much on the pro level. That's definitely a college thing because all these college guys, I mean, there's enough players out there, especially if they've been in the, they only have to be in the league a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. And it'll, I mean, they will absolutely be like, F this. Like, I'm not, you'll lose them so quick because it, you just can't do it that way. Yeah, right. Not with professional athletes. I mean, there has to be a certain amount of accountability and discipline, but the machismo stuff, I mean, you'll see it once in a while, like you're seeing behind the scenes stuff on Hard Knocks or maybe something we shoot in the locker room, like right before a game, you might have something like that, but I don't see nearly as much of it as maybe on the college level or the high school level, because I just don't think you can get away with it.
Has Hard Knocks, the in-season Hard Knocks experience, made your life easier, harder, or neither?
Neither. The way the season went was going to dictate how my year went. The Hard Knocks thing didn't change a whole lot for me. I mean, I'd been through it once before, although it was a lot more out front this time. I don't know if you remember, but the very first season of Amazon's All or Nothing was the Cardinals.
Oh, yeah.
And they covered us our 2015 season, which that was the year the Cardinals went to the NFC Championship and lost to the Panthers. So it was a really good season. And when they were doing it, there were remarkably few people that knew they were doing it. Like there was a handful of players, the coaches knew, but most of our building didn't even know. It was done kind of like on the QT so that it wouldn't impact a lot of things. But this time it was out in the open. But again, the locker room just felt really weird this whole season. There's not, because of the way it's set up, you know, players don't have to come in the locker room when there's open locker room. There's a way to avoid it now. And when it's going bad, that's what a lot of pro athletes do these days. They don't come in the locker room and then they just don't talk. And it's, you know, so it didn't really impact me as much because there just wasn't that. I mean, what impacted me a lot more was all the weird stuff that happened around this team all season and all the crazy stuff, easily the craziest season I've ever covered.
One thing I thought was that's changed in sports. I remember this happening when the New York Mets went from Shea Stadium to Citi Field, is all these newer stadiums have lots of places for players to hide. And back in the day, I'm not even joking though, like back in the day, you had to be at your locker or just getting a sandwich. There was nowhere really else to go. And now it's like freaking walking through like the catacombs. It's impossible to find players if they don't want to be found.
Well, it's funny here too. They have magnetic signs that they put on the outside of there's two entrances to the locker room. Well, you can come through like where the sauna and the showers and the bathrooms are. But the two door entrances from the training room or from the cafeteria, they put on a magnetic sign that says a locker room open to media. And they put it up when we're in there. So like even if you don't remember, when you're coming up to the door, there's a big ass magnetic sign that they flipped up there for those 45 minutes. So you can't miss it. So there are absolutely choices being made.
Right. February 1st, 2009, this is your lead, 42 seconds. That was all that separated the Arizona Cardinals from a Vince Lombardi trophy, a mere 42 ticks of the clock from an improbable comeback and their quest to, as quarterback Kurt Warner put it, shock the world. Instead, it was the Pittsburgh Steelers that got to write their own immortal ending to a title when Santonio Holmes beat three Cardinals defenders in the back of the end zone for a spectacular 6-yard tippy toe touchdown catch to win the game 27-23 at Raymond James Stadium. It hurts so bad to see that clock run down, Cardinals wide receiver Larry Fitzgerald said. To have it snatched away, it hurts. All right. So you're covering this game, but you are a team employee.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing you get a Super Bowl ring if they win. Yes.
That was probable, I would say. Yes.
Okay. If you were covering this for a newspaper and the newspaper's in Arizona, you'd probably be bummed if they lost because it's a better story to write if they win, blah, 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 blah. In your interesting spot as a reporter for the team, are you like, holy shit, the Cardinals are going to win the Super Bowl? I can't believe the Cardinals are going to, wait, what the fuck just happened? Like, what was that like?
So it's funny you say that because I'm pretty sure I said that in my head. I had covered like 7 Super Bowls before that one. I went to a number of them when I was a reporter. And then the first Super Bowl that was held after I came to work for the team was in Arizona. So I covered that one too. That was the undefeated Patriots Super Bowl. And I remember thinking actually in that one, when the helmet catch was made and the Giants take the lead, all I kept thinking was like, if I worked for Patriots.com, how sucky would that be? I was about to get a ring and they were going to be undefeated. And now I'm writing this. But you flash forward. I'm sure you've probably covered a Super Bowl or two. I'm guessing, Jeff.
Never, but, never.
Really?
Never.
So usually what happens is you head down from the press box to get in place for the media afterwards. And I went down and I have my backpack and I'm wearing a suit because that's our game day attire, wearing a suit. And I have my backpack with my computer on it. And I'm in the bowels of the stadium waiting with a bunch of other media when Larry Fitzgerald scores that long touchdown to take the lead. And I remember, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, it is what it is, but I remember almost like I had to like bend over, like I almost couldn't take a breath. I'm like, holy shit, they're gonna freaking do this. I can't believe this is actually gonna happen. And then of course I'm sitting down there and I could see a sliver of fans out where I was watching, and they had it on the TV, but they had the radio broadcast, and the radio broadcast was a few seconds ahead of the TV, and I'm listening to the Steelers march down and score this touchdown. And I'm like, it goes from like, holy crap, they're going to do it, to like, this is going to be horrible. We're going to go in a locker room and they're all going to be crushed. And then I don't know if you know this, but both teams have an after party at the Super Bowl mm-hmm. every year. And you have to set that up way ahead of time because you don't know if you're going to win. So even if you lose, there's an after party. And that was the weirdest after party. I didn't even stay as long as I could have. My wife really didn't want to be there, and everybody was kind of like, and I kind of wish I would have stayed later, because I tell people this all the time. My kids and my marriage, obviously those are the top two things, kids being born, marriage. But number three, that month of riding the wave of the Cardinals going through the playoffs unexpectedly and making the Super Bowl, most unbelievable time of my life. To be on the inside of that, to watch a city not expecting something like that and get all giddy, and you know you kind of have like this chance to be in Willy Wonka's chocolate factory and everybody else has to be outside. It was crazy insane. And I tell the young people that work for us all the time, I would love for us to get back to a Super Bowl just so you can be a part of that. Whether we win or lose, it's something that you can't even explain to somebody who hasn't been able to do it.
When I was at Sports Illustrated, I keep mentioning the Mets for some reason, this Cardinals related podcast, but I was basically the number two to Tom Verducci, baseball writer, and Tom would be covering the Yankees and I'd be on the Mets. And when they made that World Series run in 2000 and you're riding along with the team, everything just feels like a glow. Yes. It just does. Even you may have no rooting interest in it, but it's just a joy to go into a clubhouse and the music is playing and everyone's happy and and it's just the best.
You get stories either way. As journalists, we know that there are stories either way, but it's a hell of a lot easier to get stories and talk to people when it's going good. And that's just the reality. And you're in this city, which whether or not you're rooting for that team, the city gets raised up too. So that's part of it too.
Early in your career covering the Cardinals, Pat Tillman was on the Cardinals when you were there. What was he like to cover?
He was blunt as hell. the first season I covered, they went to Jacksonville, got their doors blown off. Jacksonville had the ball 9 times, scored 8 possessions. And the last one, the 9th possession, they ran out the clock. The final 8 minutes of the game, going 45 yards or something. And the Cardinals couldn't do anything about it. Me and Kent Summers walk up to Pat and say, what happened, blah, blah, blah. This is the next to last game of the season. And Pat looks at us and he goes, this is stupid. He goes, we just suck. He goes, everybody wants to bitch about the pain. Show me the baby. He was so blunt. You could tell why he was a great guy to have on the team. And one of my last memories of Pat, I sat next to him on 9/11. It was a Tuesday. The Cardinals were off, but he was in the facility. I was in the media room watching stuff go down on TV. It was after the Towers game down, but it was still in the morning for us. And he sat next to me and we're watching this. And with everything he went through, for me to think about that. And I remember at one point, I'm like, and this is one of those things where you hate it. And I'm like, hey, Pat, I hate to do this, but as long as we're sitting here, I said, I need to ask you, like, what's going through your mind right now? And he gave me some quote about it. He goes, what's going through my mind is, he goes, what we do, he goes, it's nothing. We're worthless. We're actors. And if you go back, I have a couple stories from that day. And then also when he went into the military, where I used that lead of that quote of him talking about how what playing football, he was worthless. And I was crushed when he died, super crushed when you found out how it happened. And it was just, it was a very interesting time to be around this team.
I really admired the family when they were doing like the funeral. I think his brother got up and he's like,
oh yeah,
Pat didn't believe in God, blah, 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 blah. He was just like blunt as
it
was.
They all were blunt. And it's funny when all this stuff was happening with kneeling with a flag and everything. I think Pat would have backed anybody who how they felt in terms of if you want to be upset about it, fine, that's your prerogative. But I absolutely believe he would have been one of those guys who said, I went into the military to fight for people's rights to kneel if they want to kneel. And that's my belief.
Wait, same teams. You covered a guy who I thought was going to be one of the all-time great NFL players, which would be David Boston, a wide receiver. Boston was there, for those who wouldn't remember, which is probably most of you. Boston was a Cardinal from 99 to 2002. He had a season of 98 catches for 1,500 yards, another one, 71 catches, 1,100 yards. In 2004, he was accused of punching an airline ticket agent. In 2002, he was accused of driving under the influence with coke and marijuana. He had all kinds of crazies. And I'm just kind of fascinated. What was David Boston like?
David was not super friendly. He got to know me a little bit. Again, I was with the newspaper at the time. We got along okay. My all-time favorite David Boston story, well, I had two of them. One, he went through a period where he liked to do the color contacts. We were in a road train game somewhere. I can't remember where it was. And he's facing his locker. I'm like, hey, David, you got a minute? And he goes, sure. And he turns around and he's like within like, I don't know, 3 feet of me. And he looks at me and he's got purple contacts in. And I could feel myself, whoa. Like, I didn't say it, but I could feel my body. Like, this dude's got purple eyes right now. Another time he's sitting at his locker and there was a guy, a USA Today writer, who is trying to chat him up. And David just wasn't that guy. And finally goes, you got any nicknames? D-Boss. And the guy's like, oh, where'd you get that nickname?
Oh.
And he points up to his nameplate and he goes, it's my name. Okay, I guess we're not going to get any cool stories about nicknames or anything from David Boston. He was a great athlete. He got a little too much into whatever he got into that built him up. If you see some of the pictures after he left Arizona, some of the pictures that he looked like, his upper body, especially when he was playing for the Chargers, it didn't look human.
Yeah. All right. And final question I'm required to ask is on this podcast.
Yes.
What's the best confrontation you've ever had in your career?
Wow. I'm lucky enough that I haven't had a ton. I'm not a big confrontation guy, to be honest. I'm going to try and back it off real quick. I remember being in the meal room. I get to, obviously, when I'm on the road, I eat meals with teams. Uh-huh. Well, I must have written something about Brian Robinson, the former defensive tackle, who is no longer with us. I'm wondering if he had some things happening with him. There were times when Brian Robinson was awesome with me. And then there was a time like this. He wasn't happy. There was another defensive tackle named Gabe Watson, who was younger. And Brian didn't like the fact that the team was trying to replace him with Gabe and whatever. And I might have mentioned it a couple of times. I didn't do anything harsh, but he wasn't happy with me. And one time, it wasn't really a confrontation, but he calls me over to a table and there's like 5 other guys there, five other players, and it's the middle of the meal. And I sit down and he goes off on me, and he's not quiet. And he's just berating me. And there's a table of all these players, and then there's all these other guys in the room. And I'm like, oh, okay, guy, like, let's not, that wasn't one of my all time favorites. So I had a couple guys get after me, guys who bring up, hey, you're not, why you work for the team? Why are you saying this?
Yeah.
I said a couple things back, but for the most part, I've been lucky enough about confrontation.
At least Brian Robinson was a little guy. He was only 6'4", 304 pounds.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I think all the other guys at the table were defensive linemen. So I'm not small. I'm 6'3", about 195, but he definitely made me feel little.
You're football small.
I'm football small.
Well, Darren, I appreciate you doing this a whole lot. Really loved reading your stuff. I'm not going to lie. I don't follow the Arizona Cardinals super closely.
Totally understand.
But freaking the writing's great. It's really cool hearing this perspective. And I really appreciate it a whole lot.
I thank you for reaching out to me. This was cool.
I want to thank today's guest, Darren Urban, for joining me on Two Riders Slinging Yang. You can follow Darren on Twitter @CardsChatter and read all his work at azcardinals.com. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Riders Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd be really grateful. Music is by the sizzling MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep riding.